Thanks again, Ratna Garba. So my talk's called The Myth of Tristan and Iseult, Love, Transgression and Death. I'm not going to assume you know anything about this myth. Some of you might know it quite well. Others might just be names. So I'm not going to assume you know who these characters are or how the story goes. But I'm going to try and convince you that the myth of Tristan and Iseult is a founding myth of European culture. So actually, I'm not going to do very much by way of trying to say what it means or what we can do with it. I'm not sure it's that kind of myth, or I'm not sure myths work quite like that. The way they feed into the imagination and work on us is perhaps something a bit less conscious altogether. But perhaps the ideas I do come up with might help you to relate to the myth a bit more, to find ways in. That's the idea. So let's first step right back out from any particular myth and ask, well, what is myth? Of course, myths are stories. What kind of stories? According to Joseph Campbell, the famous American mythologist, dream is personalized myth and myth is our collective dream. I think this is a wonderful definition. So we all dream. Some of us remember our dreams. If you remember some significant dream which had a narrative, you'll remember the strange associations, the sense of meaning, but the bizarreness of the thing, the way meanings, you have to feel for them, intuit them in the midst of what's going on. And these are significant for us very personally. Perhaps we can't talk about what our dreams mean to others, but our myths, these are dreams that belong to us as a culture, as a collective, not to any particular individual. There was no one person who thought up the myth of Tristan and Iseult. It belonged to European culture as a whole and emerged from a collective imagination, as it were. This is Joseph Campbell's idea, anyway. The point of talking about this is that the myth of Tristan and Iseult came out of the collective imagination of Europe at a particular moment, 12th century Europe. I'll be talking more about why that might be and what was going on at that time. And what I mean by the myth arising at that time is it met a need. And you could say it met a need in the soul of Europeans at the time. If you think of soul as our inner lives, the dimension of our existence, which is much vaster and much deeper than our conscious, rational, surface existence, that dark, vast space where everything we know has room to find a place. In that soul of Europe, that's where the myth came from, and that's where it was needed. That's what I'm going to try and show you anyway. So the myth begins. My lords, if you would hear a high tale of love and death, here is that of Tristan and Queen Iseult. How to their full joy, to their sorrow also, they loved each other, and how at last they died of that love together upon one day, she by him and he by her. Aha, it's a love story. Of course, all cultures have love stories. I doubt there's anywhere in the world which doesn't have its love stories. In 12th century Europe, when this myth got going, there was very little by way of literacy. There was very little by way of wide-scale education. Storytelling was the way people learned things. It was Europe coming out of the Dark Ages. In the 12th century, the Dark Ages were just one or two centuries back. This story emerged into feudal culture with a very fixed social hierarchy, with the aristocracy very much controlling everybody else and most people just carrying on with their lives on the land. You can imagine the storytellers travelling around in this fixed society, inspiring people they talked to with these stories and then people passing on the stories somewhere else. It was an oral culture, if you like. So this is the love story that flourished in that environment. An environment which was much less cultured than Roman and Greek civilization that preceded it, for instance. I mention that so we can talk about the image of Cupid or Eros. You're very familiar with the angelic little fellow with his bow and arrow, who shoots his arrows of love and causes people to fall in love in that way. That's a myth that belongs to classical civilization. It's playful. From that we have a sense of falling in love as something that happens to us, as if by the whim of a god. But it's nothing too serious. Or perhaps it is, but it isn't quite tragic. This is a very common image of falling in love as well. It went, or maybe it's common to Indian and Greek and Roman civilization, because in India there's the god Kamadeva, who similarly has a bow and arrow. He fires flower arrows, which have just the same effect as Cupid's bow and arrow. And of course, Kamadeva in Buddhist Tantra became Kurukula. Perhaps some of you have come across this image of Red Tara, who also has a bow and arrow and fires flower arrows to fascinate and seduce people to the Dharma. That's what the Tantra, Buddhist Tantra, did with these lightweight myths. So Tristan and Iseult, in this story, by no means is there a lightweight myth of bows and arrows. It's a much darker, much more ambiguous love, a much more ambiguous passion. So I'll summarise the story just to allow you to orient yourselves in the overall picture. Tristan is a hero. He's a medieval hero character. He lives with his uncle, King Mark, King of Cornwall. And Tristan wins the hand of Iseult, daughter of the King of Ireland, for King Mark to marry. He brings Iseult back over the sea from Ireland to Cornwall. But Tristan and Iseult accidentally drink a love potion that had been prepared for King Mark and Iseult to drink on their wedding night. And so Tristan and Iseult fall in love. Nevertheless, Iseult and King Mark get married. Tristan remains King Mark's loyal baron, lord, and therefore Tristan and Iseult continue their love affair despite great difficulties. They even try to settle down to normal lives, but they never fit in. Their love never finds a place in Cornish society. They cannot settle down, and eventually they die in each other's arms. And they're buried together. So that's an outline of the story. So far, that might sound familiar, familiarly strange, slightly unconvincing. It's the details, I think, that start to make this myth come alive. So that's what I'll do now. I'll plunge into a few details, some themes, the big themes that give life to this. So of course, we've got a hero, we've got Tristan, and we've got a princess. We've got perfect people. We've got a story about people who are regarded as the best amongst their own kind. We've got the theme of the love potion. I'm going to come back to that. That's the real centre of this story. A potion that can cause people to fall in love completely and irrevocably. And we'll ask ourselves what this means. We've got the theme of the abandonment of social duty. Tristan and Iseult do not follow their duty. They live a life of adultery and falsehood. We've got the theme of a passion that the lovers cannot satisfy but cannot give up. And we've got the theme of death because of transgression. And beyond all that, we've got the theme of a story And storytellers, the storytellers crop up in the versions, the early versions of this story. They include themselves. We've got storytellers and we've got the God who the storytellers think of as behind all the action, who never censure the lovers. They never say that Tristan and Iseult are doing anything wrong. In fact, it's the opposite. They're always on Tristan and Iseult's side. They're on the side of the adulterers, the side of the liars. So what we've got is an alternative morality. And this alternative morality is supposed to have its own superior logic, and yet it's tragic. It ends in death. So these are the themes of the story. Of course, what we're talking about is an idealized love. We're not talking about anything that ordinary people might expect to experience. Perhaps ordinary people might not wish quite to experience. It's not supposed to be realistic or a template for real life. This is because it fulfills an imaginative purpose in European culture, a purpose that belongs to the life of our desire imaginatively. And it was needed to overcome what was at the time a very anti-romantic culture. 12th century Europe wasn't a place where people were doing much falling in love. But it's not a romantic tale in our normal sense. There's not a lot of happiness, and there's not a lot of chance of the love ever coming to any kind of happiness. Whereas perhaps we think of romantic love as having a happy ending, at least possibly. So we return to dark and difficult origins of romantic love. Romantic love does start here, but it starts in difficulty, in the darkness at the back of the soul. It's worth just dwelling on this theme here. Nowadays, we take it very much for granted that we can have, broadly speaking, it's possible for us to have meaningful sexual relationships, that we can possibly find a partner who we can enjoy intimacy with without that being an entirely impossible or socially unacceptable kind of thing to do. So you've got to imagine a time where this assumption did not hold, where men and women couldn't expect to have this kind of meaningful intimacy. And that's the context of this difficult myth. So let's enter the Cornwall of the imagination that this myth occupies. It's Cornwall. There's familiar places. There's Tintagel. There's a rocky shoreline. There's the Atlantic Ocean. But it's like the London of Bridget Jones or of Notting Hill, that film. It's not quite as it really is. King Mark, for instance, he's the king based at Tintagel. That's the capital of Cornwall, this marvellous castle on a rocky outcrop, the walls of which were made by giants long ago. To King Mark at Tintagel comes Tristan. Tristan was born in Brittany, according to the stories. There's a lot of background story, which fills in episodes, if you like. The point is that Tristan's a hero. He's a medieval hero. He's a wanderer and an adventurer. He ends up in Cornwall following his own lust for adventure and discovers that King Mark's his uncle. There's that kind of coincidence. It happens all the time in this myth. And therefore, there's a special relationship builds up between King Mark and his nephew, Tristan. They trust each other completely. And King Mark wishes to hand his kingdom to Tristan in time. They love each other, not as father and son, but in a different kind of way, as king and lord, with that kind of mutual respect and honour. This myth of Tristan and Iseult, it has Celtic origins, This is what I was looking into in the background to writing this article for Urthona magazine. It was the Celtic origins of this myth. And they tell us an awful lot about how this story came about. In the French versions, which are our first versions that still exist, Tristan is said to be called that because he's a child of sadness, because he's triste in French. However, in fact, he's called Tristan because in Welsh he's Drustan. And he's the in the Welsh stories, he serves King March. And King March is married to Queen Isolt. So these characters all come from earlier Celtic stories, probably in Cornwall, but there's no trace left of these Celtic roots to the Tristan and Isolt myth. Scholars have tried to reconstruct how our myth of Tristan and Isolt might have emerged, but to no avail. The Celtic culture was mainly oral. Hardly anything was written down till after the 12th century. But the fact that these characters are recorded in Welsh myths and other Celtic myths shows that they were already in existence and turned into the characters we find in our familiar myth. So, what do heroes do? Most importantly, they slay bad guys. In this case, he had to slay Morholt, the brother-in-law of the King of Ireland, Isolt's uncle. The Morholt was a giant warrior who came over from Ireland to extract tribute from the Cornish people. He wanted 300 of the flower of Cornish youth. That was his demand, unless anyone would take him on in single combat. Nobody but Tristan would do this. And so to a deserted island went Tristan and the Morholt, and they fought for days and nights, and Tristan finally triumphed. He put his sword into the Morholt's head and chipped off a splinter. The Morholt died, and therefore Cornwall was freed of this necessity of terrible tribute. Tristan proves himself as a saviour of Cornwall. One of the little details that crops up at this point in the story is that Tristan is poisoned by the Morholt's blade in the course of the fighting. His wounds go septic. He stinks. Nobody will go near him. There's nothing can be done. He's put on a boat and he floats out into the sea with nothing in his boat but a harp. He, in his illness, he drifts on the tide, he plays his harp, he's picked up by Irish fishermen who take him to shore. And Isolt, and Isolt's mother, also called Isolt, Queen Isolt, let us say, they are skilled in healing and they heal him. They don't know who he is and they don't know he's killed the Morholt of Ireland. And he comes back to Cornwall. This shows the connections between Tristan and Isolt from an early stage in the story. They get really important when Tristan returns to Ireland. He returns to Ireland to find a wife for King Mark. King Mark doesn't want to get married. He'd be quite happy for Tristan to inherit the kingdom, but his barons won't have it. They're envious of Tristan. They force King Mark's hand. And Tristan, being a completely noble follower, devoted lord, wants to find a wife for King Mark so that he's not seen to be favoured. He goes to Ireland because Isolt, Princess Isolt, has been... it's said that if anyone can kill a dragon who is terrorising the people of Ireland, then Princess Isolt will be available to marry. Tristan, being a hero, goes straight for this dragon. with the head of a bear, the body of a lion, the fire-breathing habits of our normal dragons, but being a bit smaller, they enter into combat, and Tristan manages to slay him. Cuts out his tongue to prove that he's killed him. Puts it in his boot, but the poisonous tongue immediately knocks him out. So that takes a bit of sorting out. The Iseults have to do some healing again. Eventually, Tristan's in a position where he can say, it was me that killed the dragon, so I claim Princess Iseult. He claims Iseult for King Mark. It's very clear. He has no particular designs on Iseult at all. We should just dwell on what the relationship is between Tristan and Iseult at this point to get a feeling for what the story is saying. They're enemies as social beings. They belong to different countries which are at war. Tristan has killed Iseult's uncle. When she discovers this, she hates him. When she finds out that she has to be taken away by him to marry King Mark, she thinks this can only mean he does not respect her and wishes to humiliate her, which is perfectly reasonable sort of conclusion in the circumstances. At the very best, you could imagine that what could come out of this, of what's gone on, is a political alliance between Cornwall and Ireland. Emotions don't come into it. Perhaps Tristan and Iseult could bear each other. So the boat ride home from Ireland to Cornwall is not a bundle of laughs. Richard Wagner, the 19th century composer, his opera, Tristan and Isolde, it starts at this point. It starts with the boat ride, the boat trip from Ireland to Cornwall, and the livid tension between Tristan and Iseult. Iseult's humiliation and hatred of Tristan and his inability to do anything about it. However, on the boat, Iseult's maid, Brangwyn, has a picture of potion prepared by the Queen of Ireland. And the Queen of Ireland had said let's call her Bronwyn rather than Brangwyn, had said to Bronwyn, take all care, my child, that they alone, King Mark and Iseult, shall taste this brew, for this is its power. They who drink of it together love each other with their every single sense and with their every thought, forever in life and in death. So Iseult's maid Bronwyn is entrusted with this very powerful potion to be given to Mark and Iseult on their wedding night. But she doesn't look after it very carefully. Tristan and Iseult are thirsty. They come upon this pitcher and down they glug it. Iseult drank deep of that draught and gave it to Tristan, and he drank also long and emptied it all. Bronwyn came in upon them. She saw them gazing at each other in silence, as though ravished and apart. She saw before them the pitcher standing there. You have to imagine these two people. They've hated each other up to this moment. They've just drunk something. They don't know what it was. They have no idea what it might signify. And something is happening which they don't know. But they find themselves looking at each other and its effect creeping over them. It seemed to Tristan as though an ardent briar, sharp-thorned, but with flower most sweet-smelling, drave roots into his blood and laced the lovely body of Iseult all round about it and bound it to his own and to his every thought and desire. It doesn't sound comfortable, does it? Is it familiar? This is the gravitational centre of the story, this falling in love of Tristan and Iseult, something neither of them chose, perhaps neither of them would have chosen had they the chance to choose. Something that has happened to them as if by accident. It's the love potion that's changed from the Celtic sources. This is the great shift in the myth which changes it from a Celtic story into something which is completely different and which becomes the founding myth of our romantic love tradition. We can work this out from the Irish story of Dermod and Grainne. This belongs to the Finn cycle of the Irish mythic cycles. Different names, Dermod, Grainne, no sense that they're related to Tristan and Iseult, but it's the same story. We've got aging King Finn married to Grainne, and Finn's nephew Dermod, who is devoted to his uncle. But in this version, in this Irish version of the tale, Grainne is not so much a princess as something like a divinity. The Irish ladies have got something a bit magical about them. They can do things called a gesh, which is something in between an oath and a spell. And so she, Grainne herself, she puts everyone to sleep and then puts a gesh on Tristan because she fancies him. Not Tristan, sorry. On Dermod because she fancies him and says, "You must run away with me. If you don't, you will die." This is how these stories go in Ireland. And he doesn't want to. He wants to be the loyal subject of his king, King Finn, sorry. But he's unable to resist this gesh. So Dermod and Grainne run off to the wild wood. And eventually, Grainne does get him to consummate their love. So there's a very different kind of story. It would appear that the falling in love in that version, that early different Celtic version of the story, is not based on a love potion. The introduction of this love potion does something completely different. It gives falling in love its own autonomy. No person is responsible for falling in love. It would suggest that the lovers don't have any choice. And perhaps it suggests that in Europe of that time, there wasn't any conscious room for falling in love. So the only way it can happen is completely unconsciously, by accident. What do we mean by accident? They've just come across this picture of love potion. Now it happens that Bronwyn, who was supposed to be looking after the love potion, is also, in Celtic mythology, the goddess of love. So it's not looking quite as accidental if you look at the Celtic background. And it was in fact the Queen of Ireland who made this love potion and entrusted it to Bronwyn. Now who's the Queen of Ireland? Could it be that really she is, as Ted Hughes might say, the goddess of complete being? Which is to say, she represents the totality of our natures, of which our conscious ego is only a small part. This pagan sort of vision of the goddess very much belongs to Ireland, very much belongs to Celtic culture. It fits with her being a witch and healer and creator of magic potions. No doubt the myth, the storytellers of Cornwall, the Europeans, had no conscious idea of these kind of themes of a goddess and a goddess of love, and yet this is what is in the background to our story. Once you know this, you start to get a sense of what's coming through in this European story. Tristan and Iseult, they've fallen in love, but they're not Celtic people. They're Europeans from Cornwall. They do not avoid their social duty. they are part of feudal culture and they can't escape from it. They shouldn't have fallen in love, but they have, and this leads to constant duplicity. Love pressed them hard, as thirst presses the dying stag to the stream. Love dropped upon them from high heaven, as a hawk slipped after long hunger, falls right upon the bird, and love will not be hidden. They continue their affair when they get back to Cornwall. They manage not to be caught. Iseult manages to persuade Bronwyn to take her place in the marriage bed the first night. King Mark couldn't be too discerning. He doesn't notice. And Tristan and Iseult manage to maintain their affair. Tristan is in King Mark's good books. He's completely trusted. And in the royal household of those days, Tristan would have slept in the room next to the king. Iseult would have been very near. It was very easy, apparently, according to the stories, for them to find space for each other, to find a bit of privacy. And they couldn't not. But love will not be hidden. Those with eyes will see what's going on. Those envious barons who had wanted King Mark to get married in the first place. Those envious barons, the storytellers, they make out these barons are just evil and wicked and horrible. In fact, they're just people who want King Mark to be respected and want him not to be married to, not to be cuckolded. But the storytellers won't have it. So I've been mentioning the European situation in the 12th century. So now it's time just to make it more explicit. What was the historical situation in which this myth emerged? In 12th century Europe, there was a peculiar, probably unique combination of factors going on. There was feudalism. There was a social structure where individuals were completely subordinated to their place in a highly organized society. Marriage was contracted for the sake of many things, but probably not love. There wasn't any room for that kind of consideration in feudal society, certainly not among the ruling classes. Situation which in some ways hasn't changed a great deal now. But they didn't pretend otherwise, whereas Charles and Di's marriage was made out as this fairy tale romance, though it was not, from what one can gather. So there's feudalism. At the same time, there's Christian ethics. It's a Christian culture. And Christian ethics is peculiar in that from an early stage in Christianity, there had been a connection made between women, the flesh, bodies, therefore weakness, and evil. With that kind of set of connections, women aren't going to have a great deal of power, and sexual love is not going to be regarded as particularly morally appropriate. So this combination of marriage contracted with love not as an option, and an ethical setup where sexual love and women are pretty much downgraded, leads to a situation where the general sort of, what would you call it, moral atmosphere of the culture is almost without any imaginative connection with falling in love. There's just no room for it. So now perhaps we can understand that this myth about falling in love, about Tristan and Iseult, represents a transvaluation, you could say, of the social norms of the time, the social values. It turns them upside down. It represents a completely different picture. It introduces falling in love as something completely necessary, completely right, and yet totally at odds with what else is going on. In this way, the story opens up the imaginative space of for people's emotions to happen, really, but only imaginatively, only in terms of the story. It's not as though there's actually socially much room for people to be doing falling in love, but what we can do in our imaginations can almost make up for these kinds of limitations. And this is why in the story, adultery and lies are not evil. The storytellers really believe this. They constantly tell us how God is on the side of the lovers. Not only is God on the side of the lovers, but this love in itself has a moral purpose, because love has the effect of creating, cultivating a noble heart. In order to be in love, you have to have a noble heart. It leads to the development of this kind of heart, which means being in love has its own morality, in a way, which eschews convention. Back to the story. The king is suspicious. His barons, they continually present him with the facts of the matter. He can't help but become suspicious. They get involved an evil dwarf called Frokin. And this evil dwarf, who's got magical powers, tells the king where to go to watch Tristan and Iseult going about their wicked, adulterous tryst. The king climbs a tree in the orchard. But fortunately, both Tristan and Iseult notice he's there and have a thoroughly contrived conversation in which they don't give away the fact what they're really up to. And therefore, they get away with it. But it doesn't last forever. The lies just don't work. In the end, they're caught out. They're caught out by a ruse that the king has set. He sets them up to fail, and they do. They're caught not quite in flagrante, but more or less. So they flee. Tristan and Iseult, they flee to the wildwood, the forest of Moroi. And in a way, this is a return to paradise. This is the happy bit of the story. Tristan and Iseult, they get away from that place where their love cannot really succeed, and they go somewhere else where there's nobody else. There's just the odd hermit and the odd woodsman who doesn't really stop them going about their love. So at last they return to a sort of paradise. So in the depths of the wild wood began for the lovers that savage life, which yet they loved very soon. They passed into the high grass and the underwood. The trees hid them with their branches. They disappeared beyond the curtain of leaves. The summer passed and the winter came. The two lovers lived all hidden in the hollow of a rock, and on the frozen earth the cold crisped their couch with dead leaves. In the strength of their love, neither one nor the other felt these mortal things. But when the open skies had come back with the springtime, they built a hut of green branches under the great trees. Tristan had known, ever since his childhood, that art by which a man may sing the song of birds in the woods, and at his fancy he would call the thrush, the blackbird, and the nightingale, and all winged things. And sometimes in reply, very many birds would come onto the branches of his hut and sing their song full-throated in the new light. They live for years like this. It's wonderful. They will not repent of their love. The king even finds out where they are at one stage. But when he comes to find them, to have revenge, he finds them asleep together with a sword between them. It just happens to be there, so he assumes, naturally, that they're living a chaste life together. So it would appear that they're forgiven, that they don't need to, that in this forest at least, they're living a blessed life. This fits, in a way. This is where the open space of the imagination, there's no constriction from social convention. But the story presents an interesting twist here. Although God and the universe is constantly saying that this love isn't wrong, it's nevertheless not quite bearable. And this is because life in the woods is without civilization. This suggests that human beings need society. We need to belong to society and culture to really find fulfillment. That although we can find pleasure and happiness in outside of society, in the wild woods, something in us will never quite be fulfilled. Tristan thinks, queen she was at Mark's side, but in this wood she lives a slave, and I waste her youth. And for rooms all hung with silk, she has this savage place, and a hut for her splendid walls, and I am the cause she treads this ugly road. And Iseult thinks, see what I have done. He should have lived in the king's palace. He should have ridden through kings and barons' fees, finding adventure. But through me, he has forgotten his knighthood and is hunted and exiled from the court, leading a random life. Neither want the other to be limited in this way. They both want the best for each other. That's the meaning of their love. And that best includes honour. You could say that honour and respect. So, Tristan presents, he takes Iseult back to King Mark and manages to arrange it such that she can take up her role as queen again. This happens after 3 years, by the way. In some of the versions of the early versions of the stories, the love potion is said to last for 3 years. So could it be that this corresponds to the way the natural experience of falling in love only lasts a certain amount of time, and after that time is up, a certain sort of realism comes in. In other versions of the story, Gottfried's version, for instance, it lasts forever, which doesn't allow this interpretation. So Iseult has become queen again. The wicked barons don't quite trust her, of course. After all, she has been living for 3 years in the wild woods with Tristan. So she has to prove herself. The way they did that in those days is to put her through an ordeal by fire. This very fair form of judgment involves her grasping red-hot iron. If she's innocent, it doesn't burn her. If it burns her, well. She arranges with Tristan that he will dress up as a poor beggar, pilgrim type person, disguise himself, be next to a river where she is going to alight from a boat when she crosses that river to go to the place where this ordeal will take place. When she arrives at the place of the ordeal, gets this beggar to carry her in his arms to reach the bank, the safe bank of the river, so she doesn't get her dress wet. In other versions, he gives her a piggyback. That the early versions are a bit rougher, basically. Oop, I knew that would happen. And then the oath she swears, this is how she gets around it, this is how it works. The oath she swears that King Mark approves of is she says, I swear that nobody has had me in his arms except King Mark and this poor beggar. Or in the early versions, nobody has had me between my legs. Nobody has been between my legs except King Mark and this beggar, because he gave her a piggyback. King Mark accepts this oath, and hence she can pick up the red hot iron and it doesn't burn her. And everyone's satisfied. How's that for a porky? This is how it works. Iseult is vindicated, and she can go back to being queen as if she has obeyed all social propriety. But now begins the tragedy, really. apart. The lovers could neither live nor die, for it was life and death together. And Tristan fled his sorrow through seas and islands and many lands. Whilst Iseult could have a go at living the Queen's life in King Mark's court, it was Tristan's lot to go and wander, to carry on his adventuring, heroic trade, really, doing brave deeds, but really without ever having his heart quite in it. The story has various twists and turns here. In one of them, he does come back and see Iseult by pretending to be mad. He becomes a fool, a medieval fool. There's a wonderful episode where he manages to get 3 days with her on his own while pretending to be a fool. But they never try and go back to the wildwood days, as it were. Their love has become something different, something that just tortures them. Tristan returns to Brittany, and he marries somebody else. It's a sort of desperate attempt to be normal, really. In the story, she's also called Iseult. Iseult of the White Hands. They never consummate this union, apparently, which is, a terrible insult for Iseult's family, the other Iseult's family. Only Tristan becomes injured in one of his battles, one of his wars, and he realises that only Iseult can heal him. Iseult is summoned from Cornwall. She rushes over as fast as seas and winds allow. But Tristan's jealous wife tells him that the boat that is approaching has a black sail, which is a sign that Iseult is not on board. So Tristan, heartbroken, dies. Iseult leaps ashore, finds the recently deceased Tristan, and she too just dies on the spot. Where they die, they're buried together. And in my favourite version of this story, a hazel tree is planted in one grave and a honeysuckle in another, and the hazel tree and the honeysuckle grow up entwined around each other. A lovely medieval image of union. So it's clear that the storytellers in this myth are on the side of the lovers, and that what they want to do in this story is somehow represent the emotional life which is bursting from within them, which can find no place in normal social life. In a way, the story pushes out of this need. It builds on these Celtic roots, these Celtic stories that must have been floating around in Cornwall. But in the way of stories, it proliferates, it grows, it develops into this magnificent myth, which for the first time in European culture gives room for falling in love. In the 12th century, this was very necessary. This is a Northern European myth. It emerged in Cornwall, in Northern France, then in Germany. There's various early versions from Brittany, where they spoke both Celtic languages and French, and from Northern Germany. The finest of the early versions is by Gottfried of Strasbourg, and Strasbourg is in Northern Germany, now France. In Southern Europe, at the same time, were the poets of what's now called courtly love. These poems are slightly different, but they're doing something very similar emotionally. It was the combination of these two streams that later led to our traditions of romantic love, which over centuries developed into what we're now familiar with as our stories of romantic love, Romeo and Juliet, and so on. Just to summarise what I think is going on in the myth, by siding with the lovers on the level of imagination, the storytellers validate that completion of human nature that is to be found in passionate love. The story forgives Tristan and Iseult everything, and it heaps dispraise on anyone who would judge them. So the hearers of the story in those days, they would have consciously meditated on Tristan and Iseult's pain and destiny, and they would have kept alive that great question about this human condition. Can there be a love that meets the heart's longing, which can also find a place in ordinary social life? At that time, it was an incredibly difficult question. There was no answer. But it's one that, by raising it imaginatively, European art and culture continued to ask it. And very gradually, traditions of romantic love came about. And so European culture ventured further into this mythic kingdom of the heart. I'll just end with a little reflection on why this myth might be of interest for Buddhists. I was talking to a friend over at the community just before I came here. I mentioned I was going to be giving this talk, and he was saying, "I wouldn't wish falling in love on my worst enemy." He's married, in fact. I think he loves his wife, personally. I didn't tell him that. But that's a story you do hear, at least in the FWO, at least you used to, that falling in love is of no value in itself. I'm not sure I go along with this. I think this myth of Tristan and Iseult tells us about what it is to be European. And in my opinion, we're not products of Indian history and culture, and therefore the Buddhist worldview, the Indian Buddhist worldview, may not entirely match our emotional, imaginative situation. And in that sense, I think there's two fruits of the romantic love tradition, which began with this dark story of Tristan and Iseult. The first one is the sentimentality of an idealized union, a quasi-religious kind of ideal that if you find the right person to be with, then you will find the whole meaning of life. I leave it to you to work out whether that's a sensible ideal. The second fruit, which is in a way I mentioned at the beginning, but that we might take for granted, is that it's possible for there to be love and intimacy in the sexual relationship. This was something that was not the case in the 12th century. It may be the case in ancient India, but they have an entirely different social setup, and still do in India. Love marriages are very much frowned upon now, and it certainly wasn't different hundreds and thousands of years ago. Whereas for 200 years at least now, in our European cultural milieu, our marriages have been based on individual choice and love. This is something that's fairly unusual in world cultures, in fact. And this is, as it were, a product of the long development of stories, of imaginative adventures, of the kinds of myths, such as Tristan and Iseult, whereby people have dwelt on the possibilities of falling in love. So the myth of Tristan and Iseult was the start of our discovery of traditions of love. And perhaps it can still help us from taking it too lightly. Thank you.